Welcome back, everybody. I am John Stamp, and this is That's Criminal. Tiger was hanging out with me. He got bored before we even started and bailed because the sun's still out. So no co-host tonight. At least he's not snoring on the floor next to us. So that's something. Before we get into it, I don't have a ton going on. Again, like you guys heard last week, I'm editing. And you guys all know how I feel about the editing process. But I will, you know, I'm an optimist. One positive thing that I have come up with is that in the editing phase, it's kind of where I do most of my research. I don't have a whole lot of time locked out in my day to put words to paper, so I need to make the most of it so I don't get bogged down. I don't want to mess the flow up when I'm writing the first draft. So I usually will put a note or a placeholder in for stuff I got to go back and get right. So in the first 60 pages of what I'm tentatively calling Overmatch, it's growing on me. But as you guys know, I suck at blurbs and I suck at titles. So my internet history for Overmatch in the first 60 pages includes searching Jakarta, Indonesia, the topography, U.S. National Command Authority, U.S. National Strategic Priority, the NDAA, Chinese Intelligence Functions, the Ministry of State Security, Chinese Firearms. And in that time, that's what my search history looks like. And it's only been a week or two. And the good part, so far, no knocks at the door from three-letter agencies. That's a plus. So either we do have privacy on our persons, places, and effects, and nobody's scanning the internet looking for weird browser histories, or there's a writer's exception when Skynet or whatever algorithm they're using finds something fishy in said browser histories. And I know that this is 100% a writer's brain tangent, but in exploring the idea of a writer's exception to Skynet, I have a picture and follow me. I've got this analyst sitting in a bunker someplace getting an algorithm notification based on my searches. This guy pulls it up, takes one look, and then waves it off. He looks at his boss, who's about to task a satellite, you know, to follow me and come get me. And he says, no, stand down, everybody. It's just John Stamp. He's fine. You should see the rest of the crazy shit that he's looked into in the past. At least this time, it's not, you know, him looking up how to summon a demon or anything like that, like last time. By the way, did you guys read Shattered Circle? That was dark, but a whole lot of fun. Blood Red Ivory was pretty awesome, too. Hopefully, he gets off his ass and publishes whatever it is he's related to this time, because I'm getting bored down here sitting in this bunker. And I do know how ridiculous that sounds, but it's fun to put those wild brainwaves down on paper, because when you go back and actually read them, it serves as a really good barometer to see where you land on the scale between creative and seek help. So I use that to try and keep myself in balance. So all of that to say, Ty Benhoff 2, titled Overmatch with an asterisk, coming relatively soon. And feel safe in your browsing of the internet, because nobody's come to find me yet, and I've looked up some crazy stuff researching this book. So that is pretty much all I got, and I know that was a rout, but here we are. Tonight, I'm chatting with Eric Bishop, author of The Body Man. The Body Man, the thriller, explores a kind of a unique role for the Secret Service in protecting the president while protecting the president and the president's office. Kicks off with a kidnapping and does not let up until the end. End is not what I saw coming either. So I'm really looking forward to digging into it. Mr. Bishop grew up in Connecticut, and like many of us who grew up in the North, he relocated, meaning fled to the South after college. After becoming restless, he moved to the Rockies, the Pacific Northwest, subsequent places before finally heading back east to raise a family. After many years in corporate America, he turned his passion for the written word and dreams of crafting a novel into reality. His debut novel, Body Man, came out in November 21. He now lives in the foothills of South Carolina. We can find him exploring the great outdoors while dreaming up the next great novel. And there's stuff to live up to after Body Man, dude. So welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, John. And regarding your introduction before I came on, if they're looking at our search history closely, we're all going to end up in some hole somewhere, because they're going to get us.
going to end up rendered at some point. That just occurred to me. And as I'm reading, I'm like, you don't have to share as much, but I'm like, hey, it entertained me while I was writing it. So I'm like, I'll just go with it.
I think that was very clever. And I think all of us that write in that genre, a wide genre of thrillers and suspense and all that. I'm sure our Google searches have to make someone laugh somewhere. at least I hope they do. My first book that I wrote that never got published, or whatever, was a drone story, actually. So that obviously took lots of research. And of course, I made a lot of stuff up too. And then the second one was actually regarding a nuclear weapon that was absconded during the Cold War. And it gets found after 9/11 and all kinds of stuff. And then I was wanting to figure out, okay, what does an EMP do? You know, how does that work? And so, I mean, I've spent countless hours researching all that stuff. And there was a lot of times, and I'd save a lot of my browser history. I'd do a favorite. Oh, favorite. That's a great article. My favorite.
Yeah, that's great. Great.
And I always thought of, like, if there's someone in a room that's looking through browser history and my name pops, they got to be like, this guy's either a writer or he's a psychopath that's looking to take down our country, which is could be a combination of both. But I hope they were entertained by it at least. So I learned a few things.
Yeah, only in fiction am I looking to destroy society. And then I try to fix it at the end, right? So there's only one part of my book trying to destroy society. The rest of us are all trying to help.
Yeah, I think the rest of us try to help. I don't know. You turn on the news now, I'm pretty sure there's some people trying to destroy society, and it's not the fiction writers. I think we're the good guys.
It's funny. It's like Musk, what he tweet like a couple months ago. It's like he was giggling. Like, it turns out the conspiracy theorists were right. It's like, ooh. Absolutely. Yeah, but in the same vein, though, it kind of hurts. It kind of hurts our vibe a little bit, because we're like, we come up with all these crazy plot ideas and like, that could never happen. And then it's like, oh, look at that headline. It's like, man, nailed it.
Yeah. I think COVID, at least for me, did that. When we were living through COVID, I was writing pretty heavily at the time. And I realized, or the beginning of it, I was. Then I took kind of a year off almost of not doing much, but or nothing that I was wanting to publish. I can't make stuff up anymore. You just can't, you know. It's crazy. Things pre-COVID that we would have put on paper, if we pitched that to an agent or to a big five publisher, they would have been like, yeah, no, that's not realistic. Not today. And then during COVID, you're like, okay, anything's realistic at this point. Yeah. they can tell us to stay in our, I was in I lived in South Carolina. I had an office in North Carolina, but I was up in Hendersonville area of North Carolina, outside of Asheville, during the announcement that there was a lockdown starting of a stay at home order. That's what it was called. And I didn't have my kids that weekend that it came out. And I ended up basically loading my car up with guns, supplies, a few things. And I drove up to Franklin, where I had a friend. He invited me up for the weekend. And we just sat on his porch and we're just like, is this the end? Is it about to collapse? It was so surreal. And I'm like, if I get pulled over on the way there, boy, I'm nowhere near my house. I have multiple weapons, you know, unloaded in my trunk, and ammo's in a separate place. I'm abiding by the rules. But if a cop says, let me look at your car, I got probable cause, I'm like, uh-oh.
Do you?
I'm a good guy. Trust me. Yeah, yeah. Do you really? Yeah, exactly.
Do you today? Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a writer thing, but anytime in the past anybody's like thrown out a conspiracy theory, I'm like, hey, I'll take this ride for a little bit. Why don't we explore this? This is fun to talk about. And then, but now it's like, I'm to the point where I think it was, I was probably listening to Rogan or something, and he's laying out how all these agencies have conspired to, you know, work against social media and all this stuff. And I'm like, and I'm sitting here in my head, I'm like, you know, this sounds substantiated, but I'm so tired of this stuff. I don't want to believe this one. Like, I want to let this one pass because I'm tired. Like,
right. Exactly.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. You know? No, I think it's, well, and these, and I've talked about this in other interviews, these have fundamentally altered society. And I don't think for a positive. There's positive aspects for sure, but I think that the access to information is an incredible thing, and it's going to lead to good things. Question is will it lead to worse things than the positives that come out of technology? Because there's so much that comes out of that that's just causes lots of problems. I mean, you know, we can have this interview here and we can say something, make something up that sounds very realistic, but is an absolute lie. And that can catch fire, and people around the world can say, well, you know, John and Eric were talking about this blank, blank conspiracy going on. And, you know, it can alter the way some people are thinking. And it's just the power of technology now can, you know, where years ago, I hear that a lot. We had talked before we came on that, you know, my son is 16 and he constantly reminds me he wish he grew up like me in the 80s. Life
such
was
a great thing.
Yeah, it truly was simpler. You know, I went out during the day and I've told my kids the story. And, you know, I'm an old man now telling stories. But on Saturday mornings, I watched wrestling. I got my bike and I rode to the corner dime store, nickel store, where you could buy candy still for a nickel. I am that old. And we were on the go. And you come home at dinner time and never thought anything about that. Bad things happened to people at that time, but you weren't obsessed over it. The parents weren't obsessed over it. Now, myself included, parents don't want your kids to leave the yard without having a phone on them or someone standing on the porch watching them. And it's like, man, I miss that innocence that's gone now, I think, in many ways in society. So
yeah, and an independence is gone. Like that, you know, it was the same thing. I grew up where I would play, and this is from like 8 years old on, I was surrounded on a peninsula by Erie Canal with a lock within like 300 yards. And everything that comes with that. And we'd end up like jumping into the outflow and getting pushed down the river. And it's just like the things that people would not fathom. But yeah, just like, hey, look how much that water's rushing. And boom, there we go, shooting down the river. It's like,
right.
That's how we get ID discovery stories now, you know?
Yeah.
And all this, by the way, all this exactly. time, pretty much all of ID discovery and true crime is based on the era that me and you were running around, probably like, you know, high five and a serial killer because we like the look of the shag in his van, you know?
Yeah, I like the brown van. I couldn't figure out why it was all shade that you couldn't see in the windows. But he was giving out, you know, fireballs next to the front. And hey, I right. want a fireball. Yeah. I don't have to pay 2 cents for it in the store. This is great.
Yeah. Asked if I wanted to ride home. I was only a block away. I declined.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I'm here today.
At least now my kids will say, well, I need my steps. Sorry, I can't get in because I got to have my phone with me to get my steps in.
So. That's right. My VO2 is down. I have to get back into the zone.
Laugh or cry sometimes.
Yep. And my kids today, they don't want to ride bikes. They're just cool, like hanging out. I'm like, man, yeah. I'd be exploring every aspect of where I live. But
yeah,
I think the 80s were, I thought they were a little odd when I was growing up. But now you look back and you're like, everything was funnier. The music was 100 times better. Yeah. Freedom was a thing. And it was, but now it's like, oh man, all 80s comedies should be required reading in high school just to keep people from getting offended. Because you're ultimately, everybody's offended during 80s movies and that way everybody can laugh together. So it's,
yes,
it would, I think it would give the right people in our society today strokes. So it probably help.
It probably would help. I completely agree. So, yeah.
But yeah, that's fun. But you mentioned something a little earlier. You wrote four novels without publishing them.
Three. I had three. Okay. The Body Man was my fourth completed novel.
Yeah, yeah. That's a high degree of patience. Is it was it a craft thing, or you just wanted to make sure you got it right, or?
I don't think I knew what I was doing with the first couple books. I wrote really good stories. I had people that didn't know me that read them that were like, man, this can get published. And so I went down the rabbit hole of, okay, how do I get published? And so, I actually started off, 2017. I finished the first book in 2014, and I think I started pitching it in 2016. I guess 17 is when I went to Thriller Fest and I pitched the second book because I was getting nowhere with the first book. So I wrote a second book, pitched that, didn't get anywhere with that, wrote the third book, wasn't getting, I'd get interest from agents, but they always seem to have a reason to, and I got a lot of full requests for the first two books. They always had a reason not to. So I wrote the book in 2014 because I had a passion to write a book. I knew nothing about the publishing industry. I knew nothing about how to publish a book or how to, I didn't know you had to query agents. I didn't know any of that. So I kind of learned all that in 2015. And then I think 2016, I started getting rejections from some agents that said, well, what's your social media presence? And I'm like, only idiots are on social media. What are you talking about? Their privacy issues and all this other stuff. And they're like, and I think one of the agents had said, when you get 10,000 Twitter followers, and I forget what their other criteria was, then reach back out to us. So I was like, oh, mm-hmm. I need to actually create social media accounts and start building it. So I then started that process, which I did. What I had people in that time when I started getting rejected, people said, "Why don't you self-publish?" And at that time, I looked at it as, no, I don't want to settle because anyone can self-publish. I want someone to want me. I want someone to want my book. So by the time I wrote The Body Man, I really started to look at those first three books as my apprenticeship because I so didn't know what I was doing. And I learned so much by the fourth book that I just said, and I know a lot of authors that have made it, successful authors, that they're when they made it or got their foot in the door, at least, was their fourth book. So they have three books. I've multiple big name authors I've heard say that, which I thought was ironic. And I thought, well, I'll be next then. My fourth book got published. Yay. I'd like to revisit the first three books. And we can talk a little bit after what I'm doing next, because I'm actually revisiting those characters in my novella that's coming out this summer, as I work towards my the follow-up to The Body Man will probably come out next year. But in the meantime, I'm kind of spending some time spending time with old friends and kind of learning that world. Because I'm most like most authors, probably I write something and I put it away and I don't go back and read it. Like I've never read The Body Man. It's been out, what, a year and a half? I've never read it since. And I probably never will. I've opened it for reference and I've used like the search function on my phone or on my tablet because I'm like, what was that character's name? As I was writing the second book, I was like, wait, how did I spell their name? I don't remember. I mean, I've written, I started two other books besides Breach of Trust, which was the follow-up in the meantime. And I'm like, yeah, I need this. So I pull up my digital copy, and I put in certain keyword that I know will get me to that part of the book. And I'll read that paragraph or read that name. And then that's it though. I don't look at anything. I don't go back and read and go, wow, what a great story. It's like, I'm done. I moved on. The publisher did their thing with it. They made some changes and it's history.
Yep. And it's funny. I've been at conferences and talking to people that will go back and revise something they've already published. And I feel like I'd be cheating if I did that. Each book's an evolution. So once that thing gets published, unless there's a formatting error or something architectural, that post has to stand because the next one had better be an evolution. And the one after that had better be an evolution on that. So I kind of feel like I'd be cheating people from watching my growth as a writer to do that. But to your point of going back, I've done a couple sequels and man, it's I don't know what it is. It's cringy. Like I go back and if I go back, just use Control F. I'm like Control F in a PDF. All right, that's that. So, but if you keep scanning, I'm like, oh, like it must be like hearing your own voice on the radio. It's just like, oh man, I just can't, it's the worst.
I did a podcast last month and the person I was doing it with said, you got a really good, because I've done a lot of podcasts. I used to co-host one years ago. You got a really good voice for this. You should do it. And I've heard that from multiple people, but I'm like, yeah, I don't like listen to, like people will say, hey, I filmed a podcast with someone. Did you go watch it or whatever? Typically not. I don't want to hear myself. I don't want to see myself. It's like, I do it because that's part of the process. And I enjoy talking to people about my books and about what they do, but to have the vein, I think there was I think Johnny Depp, if I recall, I think it's Johnny Depp, like doesn't go back and watch any of his movies, like at all. He won't watch them.
I know I couldn't. Yeah.
And I can understand versus then someone, I just saw an interview recently, Tom Cruise. That's what it was. It was Tom Cruise. And they asked him the same question. And I'm going to get a Johnny Depp response. No, it was the opposite. It was like, of course I watch my own movies. And I'm like, I think I see that. I think I can understand this one.
I'll tell you, as you said that all I could think of was the last scene of Tropic Thunder. And I was like, that just changes the whole magnitude of that scene. When he's dancing in Tropic Thunder, I'm like, I wonder how many times he's gone back to watch that and just laughed his ass off.
I think Friday and Saturday night, Tom Cruise sits in a big comfortable chair in his bazillion-dollar mansion and just watches copies of his movies and probably like, I look good. I look really good.
I'll get into that. When are we going to reboot Risky Business?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's oh man, it's funny. You mentioned the all the stuff that the agents are asking for, the social media thing. I was the same boat. Like up until I heard that from an industry person, the only reason I ever even had a Facebook account, and this is for anybody listening, this is not the way to do it. But back in like 2008, working a couple cases that were going on to like a Craigslist or something else. Mm-hmm. There was no policy back then in most places on how to go about, you know, getting into the social media aspect and getting into those things. So I remember one day I had a case and I had to get on, it was either Craigslist or one of those boards or something like that. That was where, mm-hmm. where it was all going. So I remember I called my wife who was working. I was like, hey, I'm going to be on the internet and whatever you see, don't freak out. So I create a Facebook profile. I put the wrong date of birth in there. I put the wrong date of birth in there. I put the wrong place of birth, the wrong address, everything wrong. Didn't even fill out a lot of stuff just to, you know, get screenshots. If I have a legal right to be there, I'm not peeking in anybody's privacy. I'm just boom, screenshot, absolutely. Screenshot, building the case. And 2 years later, that case goes, you know, done deal. 2 years later, I'm on a TDY on the other side of the planet. And I'm Skyping with my wife. I get to Skype with her like once every couple of days. And mm-hmm. and I'm like 2 months into this thing, and we're sitting there Skyping one night, and she's like, hey, I'm, you know, a lot of people are just, you know, they want to check in, see how you're doing. And they're like, what's your Facebook profile screwing everybody up? They're like, it's they're not sure if it's you or if it's your dad or somebody else. Yeah. And I'm like, what? She's like, I'm like, yeah, I don't understand what you mean. She's like, well, I figured out which one is you and I fixed it. I'm like, what do you mean you fixed my Facebook profile? You know, when it says log off, didn't log off, left it right on
you
the
didn't
screen
log
everybody.
Off.
So she's like, no, I put all your details in there. You're all good. And guess what the first one was that she changed?
I would think your birth date would be the first thing she'd update.
Married status.
Oh, your status. Married. Okay.
She's like, don't worry. I fixed it. I fixed it all. You're good now. I'm like, thanks. Now I'm on Facebook and now I have to communicate with people.
I actually have to see people's stupid posts about what they ate and that they reconnected with an old college friend or high school. You know, yeah.
it was all perfect. I was a shadow until she brought me into the light.
You were not there. You were off the grid. So
that's right.
Yeah, Facebook's. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just saying. Now I'm in there. I'm stuck.
Now you're there.
Yeah.
Facebook, out of all of them, Facebook to me is the hardest one to use. Maybe because it's one of the older ones and just the technology's, you know, changed and preferences have changed. But I post on Facebook, I do stuff and I respond to Facebook, but it's the one I probably spend the absolute least amount of time. I'll go to it likely every day. A lot of times I'll post something on Instagram, which pushes the Facebook. So I won't even need to go to Facebook. But yeah, I don't go unless I have to for Facebook typically. So Instagram's cool. It's probably the coolest one, but it's the least interactive, obviously. Yeah. And I don't know that it helps me sell any books, or many books. Twitter's probably where I've spent most of the time, but Twitter's changed. I'm not an anti-Musk person. I won't say I like him, but I'm not like vitriolic against him. I think he's a very fascinating person. Got some issues, but got some positives. But since he bought Twitter, I have noticed a pretty distinct difference. It's a lot harder to find people. Most of the names that show up in my like trending now little thing, I don't know who any of these people are.
Yeah.
So it's definitely harder to navigate Twitter. And I'm trying to spend less time on all of them. I try to go in one time of the day, kind of post some stuff, maybe go back later, see if I have anything cupped up or look at people's stuff and, you know, and help support other authors, but try to spend as minimal time on any of them as possible most of the time.
Yeah. That's pretty much where I'm at this point is Facebook gets what I push to it from Instagram. And I go on Instagram once, twice a day to like the people who I support. I'll go retweet a couple of people I support. And the first tweet that I see that pisses me off, I'm like out. I can't handle it. Like it's either the just worthless question of, you know, what do you prefer, salt or pepper on your eggs? And I'm just like, there's no time. Who has time to ask that and give a shit what people say? And I'm like, no, done. You just ruined it for me. Ruined it for me, Karen. Twitter Karen.
Thanks, Karen. I know this morning I logged in and all I saw was posts, a lot of posts about, and this isn't getting political on anyone that's listening. It was about Tucker Carlson getting fired Monday morning or whatever, which I think I saw on Drudge Report or CNN. Six or seven different websites I look to for news, and they're all very like, one's extremely conservative, one's extremely liberal. And I figure if I go through enough like that, somewhere the truth will be in there. They're all skewed either way. But I saw that, you know, Tucker, and I couldn't tell you where Fox News is on. I don't even know if I have DirecTV or the other one. I have some satellite TV that I watch football and a few other things on, and Survivor with my kids that I DVR.
Survivor.
That's it.
I still love Survivor.
Oh, I love Survivor. We watch it every, I don't have them on Wednesdays. I have one on Wednesday, so I have both of them every Thursday. So Thursdays after karate, we get home, make dinner or get Chick-fil-A, and we sit there and we watch the Survivor from the night before. But I couldn't tell you where, even on the spectrum, the cable channels are, because I don't watch any. Last time I probably watched one was the Queen's funeral. I think I might have put on for a few minutes because I had just been to England or was going there or whatever. But yeah, so but Twitter was just, it, both sides were fired up that Tucker Carlson got fired, pro, con, whatever. Yeah. And I just went, who cares?
Yeah,
who cares?
They'll have another puppet. They'll have another puppet Monday. You'll be fine. Yeah,
absolutely.
I found a website called All Sides that I'll go to. I'll start the day with Drudge just because I'm used to it. But yeah, this place called All Sides will rank the spectrum of the articles, and actually put them next to each other most of the time. So
interesting.
You can see the skew in the headlines, and then the straight shooters right down the middle. It's so much fun. I'm like, this is entertaining. I love it.
One, basically, the one on one side says, you know, drunk man crashes into crowd of people, and the next one says Land Rover crashes into. It's like, I wonder what side that one's on. So it's the Land Rovers. That gas guzzling Land Rover is now killing people on its own. So.
That's right. Yeah, it's like the what is it? The escaped convict shoots four people, or no? It was the Glock 19 shoots four people. Like, doesn't.
No, I'm pretty sure it was the Glock that did it. They're autonomous now. We've upgraded them with nanotechnology and whatever was in the vaccine.
I'm going to find that upgrade. There's nothing I want to do more than have a nice conversation with my gun while I'm in the range.
There you go.
You shoot so good, man. Look at that. No, it'll shoot better. It's you. Yeah.
No, if you compliment that thing, it's good. It's like good dog. That dog's going to love you more, you know?
That's right. I try to talk nice to him when it's doing its job.
Too funny.
But yeah, it's usually operator error, so I don't blame the gun. Getting back to your, you know, you taking that time to put on those three books and the evolution of them. I think when we talked last time, you know, to get into the Body Man, there was a couple of rollovers from your earlier books to the Body Man, correct? Well, didn't a character or two make a
crossover? So I went, so basically when I finished the third book, so the first book I wrote was called Vengeance. Then I wrote a book called it. As I finished that book, I had a really great character that people really loved. And so I decided to tell his backstory. And it's a real weird name, but the second book, which really it's like Star Wars, the first chronologically, was called The Zachariah Option. So The Zachariah Option was a nuclear story. Then the third book went back to present time with this character, and it was called The Vigilante. So I was kind of in this world of these characters. And then when I wasn't getting it sold, and I came up with the concept for what the Body Man was, I just said, I'm just going to clean slate, start fresh. And I'm grateful I did. I needed it. But like I said, I kind of feel like those characters, I wrote three books about a handful of them that are in all three, that, man, I've got unfinished business. With those voices are still in my head sometimes saying, hey, you created me and now you put me on your hard drive. You jerk. So it was, the Body Man though was complete, come up with, you know, brand new concept. And I've told the story, especially a couple of years back when I was doing media for it and stuff. It was interesting. I was at the time, I was married, which is different from now. I was doing a cleaning job. So this is, I don't even remember what year this was. Fortunately, I think once everything got done, I think I erased a couple of years of my life. So the details get fuzzy, but I remember this part really well. I was doing a cleaning job on a Friday night. I was, I think, shopping around the second or third book. I wasn't getting anywhere and I was just frustrated. And I said, I need something new. I need a new motivation, because I only wrote at night when my wife at the time and my kids went to sleep. So I wasn't writing during the days. I wasn't taking family time up. That was my time to get the demons out of my head, to tell these stories. And so I walk in this, it was a fire sprinkler company, which is in the Body Man. There's a fire sprinkler. It's not a fire sprinkler, but I use the name Dybico. Dybico is the name of the fire sprinkler company I was working at on a Friday night. Literally a college-educated financial analyst who's low-income family cleaning an office building on a Friday night because bills. There's bills in life. Yeah. And yeah, no one's paying my bills. I don't have two incomes, so I got to survive. So I walk in, I turn the alarm off. And it wasn't like, and I've told this before, it wasn't a voice. It wasn't like some mysterious thing. I just had this thought pass through my head real quick. And it said, there's always someone who knows where the bodies are buried. And I was kind of like, what the heck is that? And I'm like, what is that, a mafia thing? I'm not going to write a mafia story. And then I answered my own question. Well, who would know where the bodies are buried? And my brain said, well, the body man. And I'm like, okay, well, that's weird too. And then I remembered, it was probably months before that, I had seen a news story about President Obama. This was before Trump got in office, or right around the time Trump was coming in, maybe. But I saw this news story, and it was about President Obama, and he had a guy that worked for him, Reggie Love, who's a real guy. I know Secret Service agents that know Reggie. But the media called him the body man. And basically, he carried Obama's BlackBerry and probably his smokes and his credit card. And, you know, Barry would say, hey, I want that, you know, get me the, you know, the Marlboro Reds. And, you know, Reggie would go over there and buy the Marlboro Reds, and the president would be happy.
No witnesses.
So I thought about that story, but I thought about the term the body man. And I'm like, well, that would be a really freaking boring story to just be kind of an admin for the president. I mean, maybe something interesting would happen. You know, if you're JFK's admin, you know. Yeah.
One of those days.
Marilyn might be fun to talk to. But I have a feeling that wasn't going on in more recent administrations. So I had like 3 hours of doing this mindless cleaning job. And I said, well, what would the body man do? And so I kind of then said, well, what if instead of the body man being, and I thought Secret Service, because White House, the president, and I was like, well, instead of him maybe being a Secret Service agent who's protecting the president, what if he was protecting the office? And what if he had to protect the office from the occupant at the time? And the idea, just like the high level of what you read for the book, came from that night. I made lots of changes over the years, but that's where it all flowed. And then I was like, fired up. And I knew when I was coming up with the idea, man, if I can write what I'm envisioning, then this will get me my foot in the door.
Was that,
it took years, but it did. So
was that one of those moments where you're like, I really got to get this office clean, but I'm going to need 10. I got some stuff I got to scribble out. Like, did you just like sit down and be like, let's just fill up this notebook?
No, I didn't. So the way my weird brain works is I'll come up with an idea and then I'll just stew on it. Like I started a novel last summer. And I wrote about 20,000 words. So it's not like I just wrote 500 words. I wrote about 20,000 words, but I got to a spot in the story in my head that I hadn't got far enough. And I just put it aside and I've not looked at it since August, September. I don't even know. So I can just let things. And so every now and then I'll have something pop in, and I keep the good thing about the devil here, the technology.
Oh, yeah.
Is everything's on the cloud. I have Microsoft. I have notes, Apple Notes. And so I just keep detailed note, and it's backed up. And I even sometimes copy it, email it to myself, to my Gmail account.
Oh, yeah. So it's I do like too.
Multiple. So in case the cloud gets fried with the EMP that goes off, you know, hopefully I've printed off that email. If I haven't, it's gone then. But so I'll just like kind of make detailed notes, and kind of like if something happens in a day, I'll be like, oh, that would be good for this story I'm working on. And yeah, then I just... And life gets busy, you know, as we talked about before, writing is not my full-time gig, doesn't even really pay the bills. It's a fun hobby. I hope it will pay the bills one day, but it's something I'm passionate about, but it's not something I get to do 8 hours or 10 hours a day.
Yeah. I can't wait till that day comes.
Yeah. Me too. And it's, you know, some people get it off the bat, first book, they can quit their day job. From what I've read in the past, it typically takes authors between 5 and 6 books before that are successful authors, not just, you know, Joe Blow selling 100 copies. These are people that are, you know, maybe not making the Times list, but not too far off from that. It'll take them 5 or 6 books before they can quit their day job, because when someone finds that 6th book, they don't just go, oh, cool, John Stamp wrote a great book. They'll go right by your first 5 as well. So at that point, when you find new people, they're starting to buy 4, 5, 6 books, and you're getting real residuals. Or you get a book that hits that you get a big advance for that sold well. And that definitely happens. But if you think that's going to happen, and if you're getting ready to sell the farm and have that be your ambition, you're probably going to jump in the canal and not come back up.
Yeah, get some concrete evidence first.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And it's the way I look at it is it's, you know, like anything, any career, it's a 10-year process to build. Yeah. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You could be a rock star right out of the gate, but it's going to take 10 years before you know what you're doing anyway, right. You know, enough to really get it done. So that's how I've always liked it. As long as the stories keep coming, I keep writing and, you know, hopefully evolving, like we talked about, hopefully evolving with the work. So,
right. Exactly. Well, and I think you appreciate it more. I think from things in life that I've earned and really had to put in the sweat and the hard work, you appreciate the results more. And I'm not saying people that hit that first book and make the sellers list or get a six. I mean, there's people just in the last couple of years that have gotten, you know, it's out there. So I'm not, you know, telling stories, but they've gotten 7-figure deals, movie deals.
Oh yeah.
God bless them. I support them. I don't care if someone gets that deal and the book's maybe not even my professional, my book that I would like to enjoy reading. I still support that because that gives me hope and other people hope that those things are out there. You just can't expect that thing to happen because it's such a minuscule opportunity for people or a chance that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So you have to put in the hard work. Like
you just got to grind like everything else. Yeah. And it's one of the biggest things in this isn't a perfect matchup, but did you ever read Dave Grohl's Storyteller?
I've not. I've walked by it so many times in the store and I've not read it. So no.
I'm a Foo Fighters like lunatic. So it's,
okay. I love the Foo Fighters. So I need to read it.
But I mean, his thing, you know, from 16 on, he's just faking his age to trying to get into like New York punk bands and maybe gets a couple tours, maybe gets to go national and then falls into Nirvana. But he's paid his dues living on the road since he's like 16 years old.
Yep,
so that grind continues and continues. Nirvana falls flat. Thanks, Kurt. Now, I hope it's not too soon to say that. And then he just does it his own way. And it's like, look at him. I mean, it's
been a while. Grind. I think you can say that.
I think so. He just never gave up and just kept that grind going. Now he's an institution. So it's like.
Exactly. And not an overnight success.
Nobody really is. Even those people who, like you said, came out of the gate, they've been writing for years, organizing, planning.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and the other thing I was going to say, too, again, I would have been glad if the Body Man came out of the gate and was some massive thing. Trust me, I wouldn't be like, oh, man, that's just I wish I had to
I feel pay like more I should have struggled more.
I really wish this sucked a lot more than it actually did really suck to come out with my first book. But one thing that I've realized in watching that success people have had is the scary part of that is, man, if you come out of the gate and your book is a massive seller, that puts a lot of pressure on you to have that second book be a massive seller because the publishing industry has good pros and strong cons. And all they really care about at the end of the day is, are you going to make them money? And so if you make them a lot of money in the first book and your second book makes them okay money, but not so great, and your third book is making them less money, they don't care that first book sold well. They will drop your ass in a heartbeat before you get to book four or after book four. And then your career is almost over. So, you know, you want like that bell curve. You want that curve to start almost lower and build yourself up for a career that's going to actually benefit you better in this industry. And this industry is an interesting industry.
Yeah. And there's two sides to it, but I mean, yeah, you're only as good as you were yesterday and
correct.
You know, there is no tomorrow, but at the, you know, like you've said, you alluded to the authors, when you get the authors together, there is not a more supportive bunch of people. I mean, everybody, no. I've never met an author that was like, you know, backstabby. I've never met an author that was like, oh, that's, you know, I'm really glad that your life sucks. You know, everybody's always cheering each other on. Everybody's really supportive of everyone, which is, I think that catches people by surprise sometimes. I think they kind of expect the artist side of things to be a little catty. And I've yet to experience a catty author. I'm sure they exist. I just haven't seen any yet.
They do. I know of a few. Mm-hmm. I've not really had much direct experience with them, but I know via stories or via a few things. But I'd say 98% of the ones I've met or interacted with are absolutely just what you said. And I think there's a couple, I've been talked about that with other people, and I think there's a couple factors to it. First of all, you don't, it does happen, but you rarely see an author that is very young. So for most authors, this isn't their first career. They started a different career. They might have been successful. They might have been a failure. So they kind of build some life experiences. And typically, if you go through life and you're not an asshole, you're going to have a healthy respect for what it takes to be successful. And seeing other people struggling, you want to help them. And especially in the writing community, you're not, it's not you working at Bank of America that's seeing some guy working at Target and you can do anything for them. That's a stretch. When you're a writer and you go to a conference, you meet someone and they go, man, I've been working on this manuscript for 2 years and I don't know if it's any good. You will go, well, man, let me take a look at it. There's a part of you that goes, man, I was that guy a couple of years ago. And in my case, I have multiple like New York Times bestsellers that gave me attention, gave me support, and were there from the early part of me starting to write. And I was a nobody. They didn't owe me 5 minutes of their time. They didn't owe me an email or a phone call, but they did that for me. And I respected that so much that I immediately said, man, I don't know if I'll ever make it in this business. And whether I do or don't, I'm always going to remember that other people helped, and I will make damn sure. I mean, the only books I've really read this year are from people that are not highly successful authors, just like myself, because they've sent me books and said, hey, would you read this or give me a blurb or would you do that? I'll put down a New York Times bestseller to pick one up for someone that's not a bestseller because maybe I can help them, maybe I can't, but I feel like, man, I want to help them in any way I can.
So, I mean, that's where this whole podcast comes from. I flip through me flipping through Amazon, like, that looks cool. That dude's got a cool story. Let's put them on a list. And, I've had some bestsellers on here, but if they seem interesting, if the story in the book seem interesting, I call. Otherwise,
absolutely.
I'm sure at some point I may have to go a different route, but I mean, it's, we just talk shop. That's what I do here. Yeah. We talk shop. You know, when I'm not talking to true crime people about cases, we're talking shop and talking about the process.
Well, I think authors also, they have that you've got that common interest. So you have something, and it's something that very few people actually have in common. And it's not to say that there's not too many people that write, but if you look at the population as a whole, the average person is not going to complete a novel. They might start, some people might start writing, but to actually put in the effort to complete a novel is very rare. Then it opens a whole another can of worms of, can you get that novel published? Is it any good? Yeah. Is it only something your mom's going to say, I'm proud of you. Your mother better be proud of you. She birthed you. She should be proud of the crap you wrote.
It's a year's work and 100,000 words.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But so I think authors, they have that healthy respect and they have that camaraderie with someone that says, okay, this person put in the effort like I've put in, and they respect that. And yeah, with the exception of a couple buttholes out there, this is a great group of people. And you do that if you go to conferences, just social media, most big name. First time I got followed by a New York Times bestseller, I was like, it was years ago. I was like, holy cow, they're following me. And so I messaged them. Thank you. They messaged me back. Oh, you're welcome. What's up with you? What are you working on? And I was shocked. I was shocked to have like an interaction, because that's the positive art of the technology. I've talked, it's crappy. There's a lot of downsides, but some of the positives are just that you can interact with people that 25, 30 years, when we were growing up in the 80s, I couldn't, call Mel Gibson and say, hey, Mel, I really have an idea for a story for a movie. Would you do that? Mel wasn't answering me on his massive, phone that's, that's bigger than his head. So now if, someone is active on social media, there's a possibility you can catch their attention or get one-on-one time with them, even if it's only a couple minutes. And sometimes that's the cool thing about it, is giving someone a few minutes of your time can change their life. It can give them confidence that they're going. And that's the one thing I've tried to do with what I've done with my writing, is just encourage people. I'm not the best writer out there. I'm not the best marketer or any of that stuff. But I tell you what, I do believe in people. And I believe that if you put your mind to something, you can accomplish it. And there's only one person that's going to prevent you from doing that. And that's yourself. You can stop yourself. You can prevent success. To achieve success is another story. But if you want to prevent success, it's easy. Give up. Quit. You're guaranteed to fail.
Yeah, and I think it's probably come up here before, but this is one of those, rare instances where there is no team. There is an I. There is absolutely no team when you first decide you're going to write a book. There's
No.
is that everybody else will be like, "Oh, you're writing a book. That's great." And they'll never ask you to finish it, but they'll be like, "Oh, he's writing a book. It's like he's been doing that for a decade. Cut it out."
Yeah.
So it's there's nobody watching, nobody in the mirror but you. So
No,
it's
absolutely. And you're accountable to yourself, and that's a scary thing, but to me that's a great thing. That's a powerful thing. And now after doing it, let's see, I finished five books, two novellas, got a couple other short stories that I've done, and then I've got probably just in the last couple of years, I have three or four in some form of production. A lot of them are 20. I seem to get to 20 or 30,000 words, and then I just become an idiot and don't finish. Don't and I jump. Then I get passionate about the next idea, and I'm like, "Oh, this is the
There we
big one
go.
that's going to get me the G650." Yeah,
That's
right.
right.
And so I put the other one aside and go, "I'll keep thinking about that one, and I will finish all those books unless I have a an early demise for some reason, which is probably going to be due to the phone, the
Yeah, the
technology."
man, the
But
phones. Yeah.
yeah, so but being and that's the other thing I tell people is you get one done, and hopefully, at least for me, and hopefully for others, that instills the confidence in you of going, okay, I can actually do this. And I think it really starts, it's almost like pushing a ball, on a small incline, but it's not moving yet. You got to get some momentum going. And once you can get that first story out, I think finishing a second one, because you got that confidence, you then say, okay, I've done this before. Now you might have
Yeah.
imposter syndrome kick in and say, well, I did this before and it sucked, or only my mom liked it.
Yeah.
Sure. But you should look at that and going, okay, I had a goal. I figured a way to accomplish that goal. So what's my next goal? I know I can do it because I did it before. Maybe my next goal is to get the second book or go back to the first one and get it published. But if the first one doesn't get published, okay, you finished the first one. Great. I finished three of them. It took till my fourth one that I was like, okay, I can actually get this thing published.
Yep. Yeah. We build on the next one.
Build
Just
on the
trying to
next one.
make the
Absolutely.
next one a little bit better, honing the craft a
Yes.
little bit.
Absolutely.
Which brings me back. So, looking at your spectrum from one to four, could you like for me as I'm overmatch asterisk overmatch as in editing this book and even in writing the first draft, I kind of got to the point where I declared war on filler words. Like I'd seen them in the past and I'd chipped them away as I could, but this time I'm writing my first draft and I'm like, there is no had unless you can justify your existence. There is no that unless you can justify your existence. There's no word with an ly on the end unless you have a really good reason for being here. And it's so can have you seen that spectrum change between the first book and the body man? Just the little things that you keep carving away at.
Absolutely. And I still make a boatload of mistakes, but before I made a continent worth of mistakes. So I've shrinked it down now, where before it was the United States. Now I'm just messing up South Carolina now. So
There you go.
yeah, you learn. Hopefully you learn, and you just get, and like you said before, you get better at the craft. Yeah, there's things that I would have never, and in the past I would have just said whatever too and said, I'll clean it up during editing. Now, no, now I'm a lot more intentional. Probably because I realize how much work it is to go back and edit before I let anyone else look at it. But I'm like, and some people, I know there's a million ways to, not a million, but there's so many ways to do it. And some people, I don't know if it was David Morrell, someone I saw an interview or I interviewed a couple of years ago. They would write a chapter, and then for the day, that was their writing. They wrote one chapter, and they'd start their next day by editing the day's before chapter
Yeah.
before they finished the second one. And so by the time they got to their final, I can't remember who it was now, if it was Morrell, but by the time they got done, that first draft was pretty clean. I've never gone to that extreme or anywhere near it. So I'm trying to be more intentional as I'm doing it, because I don't like to go then look back. Because like we talked about before, my problem, and I think probably a problem a lot of authors have, is if I don't have a set deadline for myself, even if a publisher hasn't given me one or whatever, if I don't have a set deadline, I could go back and fix that book until I die,
That's right.
because it's never good enough. It's never, and that was a hard thing for me when I had to give over the final draft of the Body Man to the publisher. That was tough because I realized at that point I could no longer fix my stupidity. I could no longer come up with a wittier comment for one of my characters or describe something different. And that's partially probably why to this day I've not gone back really and reread it, because I would be pissed off. I'd be like, why would I say, why did I box myself into the corner? This character now has to have this kind of hair, or this girlfriend that was named this. I hate that name now. Why did I name her Karen? What the hell was I thinking? You know,
I've never
sorry,
seen
all the Karens out there, please buy The Body Man and buy John's books too.
So, that's right.
But so it's, that's why when it's done, it's done. Okay. Move on. You know, you're a Foo Fighter fan, on to the next one. That's a lyric from Foo Fighters. Done, on to the next one. It's like, just bring me to the next one.
Yep. Yeah. I just can't, like, it creeps me out, and well, I'll do it when I have to, but just going back and retreading it, I'm like, no, that work is done. Hang it on the wall. Let it, you know, let's see what people think of it.
Absolutely.
But to get back to The Body Man, I do want to discuss, we've been discussing everything but
The Body Man,
the book.
I got to remember what the story is about, John. It's been a year and a half, and I haven't read it, so I might make some crap up here. Yeah, yes, John, that's exactly what I was thinking.
I was, it's funny, in another tangent, but I was gathering up some stuff for something to do with Blood Red Ivory just yesterday. And I landed on a piece that I wrote for it for my publisher as a marketing piece, and it's a thing where he's doing a crime scene, like trying to pull a fragment out of a tree or something like that, and ends up having a standoff with a bull elephant while a anti-poaching ranger sneaks up behind my supposed hero. You know, and I'm reading it, I'm like, man, like, I don't remember, like, for a second there, I was like, I don't remember writing that. Like, I was like, well, and it was only a year ago, but it was like, well, okay, I got it. It came back to me eventually, but I'm like, man, the guy got caught with his pants down. I'm like, come on, man. I thought you were better than that. But with, okay, let's get back to The Body Man. But, the premise, the guy whose loyalty is to protecting the office rather than the president, I think on the surface, it doesn't seem that big of a thing. That's our job. Our oath is to the Constitution. It's not to that. It's the whole reason it's codified in law is our oath is to the Constitution of the United States, not to an office, not to a man. And it was done intentionally even back then when that law was written. And it also reminded me, and my history could be way off, but I went to work at the FBI under Bob Mueller. Before him was Louis Free, and Louis Free and Clinton. Louis Free was appointed director of the FBI by Clinton.
Right.
And story goes, and I'm not telling history. I'm telling, you know, the way I've been told it. But it was, you know, one of those things. Once the Lewinsky stuff, the Whitewater stuff, all this stuff starts coming up there, and there that presidency, he's called in to chat with Clinton, and he famously, at least among the bureau, says, you know, I respect you, Mr. President, but I my oath is to the Constitution. My oath is to the laws of the United States. So, you know, careful what is said here, because I'm a law enforcement officer, which is, I mean, that's what I thought as I'm a couple of really great scenes that I don't want to give away. But there were some words spoken during that book, and I'm like, nailed it. I'm like, that's exactly what a guy who gives his oath to the Constitution of the United States says to the person that he's got to take out.
So what I tried to do with that, and we've talked offline about this, because I still to this day, I'll have people say, well, you worked for the government before, or you do currently. And they can, I'm glad for them to believe that. And yes, I really do. Yeah. But officially, I know I'm a financial analyst with a title insurance company, and I know nothing about how things really work. But no, I tried to get in the head of a character of what I limited know about the FBI or the Secret Service and what I can research. But almost, how would I want it to work? So how would I want, so if I had a character, a role in the secret, in, you know, that came from the Secret Service, that works in the White House, that's with the president close to 24 hours a day in some proximity, what would I want that person's responsibilities to be if their job wasn't to protect the president, if their job is to protect the office? Well, you know, and I thought back to Clinton. I thought back to other stories that about there about Johnson. And I've just read a book about the Secret Service for another book that's totally not Body Man, but is Secret Service related, that I'm about 25,000-30,000 words into writing. And it was talking about, it was written from the perspective of former agents. It was a really good book, and I'm totally drawing a blank now off the top of my head what it's called. but it was talking about what the agents thought about Carter and what they thought about Johnson and Nixon and all that. And it's like, you know, these guys have an absolute critical job. That's an absolute crappy job that you get to see these people on their best days and on their worst days. And you can't do anything about it. Well, what if there was a role there, though, that they could step in? Like if you know, use Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, I don't reference President Clinton in the book, but there might be a reference to an incident that occurred. Well, if you could actually stop the president from having a young lady come in the house because you go, this could lead to problems, that can change history, can change, yeah. You know, no one before the 1990s on national media and everything was talking about oral sex. But they were after the president got busted. And now college, you know, high school age kids, you know, of course, with technology now, everything's everywhere. But it changed really almost the fabric of our society. Well, what if one person could have prevented that? What if the president does whatever? It opens this layer. And then the other layer to the onion of that is, okay, and it really factors into the second book, Breach of Trust. What if you have someone with that power? They're not elected. You know, they're appointed, they're given this job of the body man. It is a massive amount of power because you can actually physically prevent the president from doing something, or you can step in and say the president does something horrific, kills someone. Your job is to clean it up.
Yeah.
Really? Do we want someone with that much power that can whitewash a crime that is never acceptable for someone in that, you know, institution to do? So in the second book, I explore that a little bit more of what does that lead to, and what happens to that position if other people find out about it and go, we don't want someone unelected in that position. Yeah. And I don't know how you would ever elect someone, because how would you choose that? You know, I mean, John Stamp would probably be a great, you know, body man, but besides you.
No, I don't do protection.
But you would only do good.
That's right. That's right. I can't be bought. I cannot be bought.
I have a Cayman account I was going to share with you after this interview, but I won't. Right. So,
well, what I was wondering, one of the notes I made was, you know, knowing the atmosphere of politics to a certain degree and the government and how government works, what happens to Jordan after? You know, there's always a new case, so there's always a new post. You know, he does what he does in the body man. Where is his future there? You know, surrounded in D.C. by an absolute nest of vipers who are usually only out for number one. What's his future look like? You know, it's just,
so I will say he's still in the second book. So he does have a future. I will admit he does have a future. I believe I mentioned in the book. I don't think I edited it out. That's probably why I need to reread it. How I describe it is, once that tenure ends, once that position's over, part of the deal of taking that job is you don't just then get a new job in the White House or a new job in DC. To take on that role, your agreement is you leave, you're gone. You basically have a early funded retirement, and you have one thing to do. Whatever you saw whatever you did while you were in that position, that dies with you. That secret dies with you, which actually factors into the third book. The third book, I've got the premise behind it down, and the people that used to serve as the body men, starting with Kennedy's body man, are actually the Kennedy's body man. And I've written it. I've written the first chapter of the third book. Kennedy's body man is the first chapter of the third book. So what happens then after the role is kind of broken out into that book, actually. And I think it's a cool, if I ever get to writing it, it's a cool concept. So
that's
what would you do if you've been to that cool level? I don't think, you know, getting a white chocolate mocha for someone at Starbucks is going to be too on your list of your career aspirations after you've done that.
Yeah. I think a ranch in Wyoming, probably like the size of Yellowstone, would probably be my price.
Island in Bora Bora. I do have a price. Might not be bad too. Yeah. So, you know,
you broke me, Bishop. You found my price.
Yeah. I'll make a few calls, John. See what we can arrange. So the body man, I'll talk to the body man later. He can hook us up.
No, Secret Service works too hard, man. They travel too much. I don't know if I could do that gig.
No, I know two former agents. One of them I haven't talked to in a while. The other one I've talked to on a fairly regular basis. And yeah, that's again, I don't have any experience with protective detail, but I think it's from what I've known and talking to agents, reading about it, they have like a 99% divorce rate, like astronomically high divorce rate. The only way they don't get divorced is if you marry another agent, because you both know the gig and you're never both neither home. So you can't possibly fight. You can just get together for fun rendezvous and be like, see you next month, when we're in Japan,
It's a lifestyle. It's that one is for the friends I have in that agency. It's a lifestyle. They just have to agree with it. And it's, life changes in phases. So what's great in the 20s doesn't work in the 30s anymore. And but that's good on them. I mean, that's some interest. That's some rough work, but man, it is busy.
The agents I know that were, and the ones that I personally know and have talked to are former Secret Service. And I think that's what you end up finding. Yep. Is people might jump into that kind of career in their 20s because, there is a certain allure to that of, wow, this is exciting and getting to travel with the president. If I make it to the protective detail and do all that, really cool. You're in your 30s and you have two kids and you're working 80 to 100 hours a week, maybe sometimes, or you're going away on trips for a week or two. I think that's why you see people leave and they go they've started to get government service at times, so they don't want to just quit and go work at Pratt & Whitney or, Microsoft or whatever. They'll go to another government agency that will tenure their time, which is smart on their part, so they can get a retirement. For a family lifestyle, it equates a lot to the military. One of my closest friends retired a couple of years ago. He actually stayed single. He was part of Fifth Group. I don't have him here where I am, but I've got a wall of flags, stuff he got. He got me a flag from when they invaded and came through Jordan in the invasion to Iraq. I have a flag that was flying on the border, and I have these really cool artifacts.
That's cool.
Amazing stuff that he was kind enough to give me. But in talking to him while he was active duty, he would tell me the stories of, these guys in his team would come back and, their wife cheated on him or something. Obviously, sometimes soldiers are cheating on their wives and just, horrible family things are happening, or they're gone. They're deployed for 8 months. They're home for 3 months and gone for another six. They see their kids via FaceTime or Skype, and emails to each other. It's such a difficult lifestyle. It's something you have to be prepared to do and a sacrifice to do. And my friend wasn't willing to. He said, I'm not going to get married while I'm in this service. I don't want to have a family and have that lifestyle. It's a challenge. And I think Secret Service and, there's FBI jobs, obviously, that require a lot and require you to move and, do long hours. And, I applaud those that take on those roles. And I understand why sometimes people don't stay with them for a full career because of what they have to give up.
Yeah. Life changes. I will say something really cool that I didn't expect when I got hired by the FBI. First of all, every step of the process, when I'd leave, I'd call my wife immediately and say, there's no way I pass that. We're not going anywhere. but I did, once I got my offer and I accepted, they actually brought her. We lived in Charleston. They took her by herself to the Columbia field office for a spouse orientation, which was something I'd never heard of. I mean, that's a very cool thing for the agency to do to get me out of the process, get the variable out of the way. The dude who's super psyched about being Elliot Ness. Take her up and have her talk to other people. It was a very cool thing. I don't know if every place does, but that was very impressive. The FBI was very impressive, but that was one of the cooler things. I think it really sets those spouses up for their expectations to understand what they're walking into sometimes.
Absolutely. And I think that's helpful. I don't know if I told you when we talked before, I was fortunate. It was actually after I had finished the first draft of The Body Man, but I was fortunate to be recommended, and I did Citizens Academy, the FBI Citizens Academy. I did it out of the Greenville field office or small satellite office. It was 10 weeks. I think it was 10 weeks, 2019, 18. It was a few years ago. That part I forgot about life, but I was able to get a good low level view from agents of what they actually did. And I mean, the worst night, I've told the story to other people, the worst night from a, oh my goodness, parent perspective was the night that they went into pedophiles and online predators and all the things that had happened. And they were very detailed and very, not graphic, but I guess it really some of the stories, I guess, were nothing visual, but just what the, I mean, I came out of that meeting and at the time my kids were, you know, much younger, especially my daughter was probably 6 or 7, I think, when that was going on, or when I was doing that class. But to see what those agents have to, the type of people they have to deal with. And this one operation they were talking about was how they were posting stuff online and they were getting these guys, and it was mainly guys, they're dirtbags, they're not women that are typically doing this, it's guys, to come to a hotel or whatever it was to engage in illicit activities with minors. And basically they couldn't set the appointments up fast enough. And they said, we could do this all day long every day.
Yep. They come running. Even in a small town like Greenville, they'll come running.
Yes. It blew my mind. And it made me so mad as a parent. It made me so mad as a man that there's people out there that are scumbags that are doing this. But yeah, that was the hard one. But on the positive side was, I think a lot of people that took the class like were made to by their employers, by their community leaders, because half the class didn't want to be there. That's I was wanting it fun. For, oh, every day I was giddy to go to it. Every day I got to do it. It was once a week for like 10 weeks, I think it was. And every day. And so, and I'd always be the one, like, they'd be like, who wants to put on the bomb suit? And I'm like, and they're like, writer. And they'd call me the writer. Okay, writer, you're on the bomb suit. And the rest of people are like, whatever. And, you know, I'll go roll around in the 70-pound bomb suit. And, you know, we had a shoot, no shoot drill at the end. They set up all the screens and everything. And I think I had a guy pop up behind an air conditioner and I drilled him like 3 times. And so the instructor actually looked at me like, how'd you know the guy was coming from Hattie, you know, the unit? And I'm like, well, I knew someone was popping up and whoever it was, I was shooting. I was like, if I don't get a chance to shoot people in games like this, if it was grandma, I'd be like, sorry, I popped grandma, but someone's going down. He popped out of, who would be, a grandmother wouldn't be behind an air conditioner unit.
That's right. She couldn't move that fast. Unit,
you're probably a bad guy. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you're the one calling me the writer. I could see that plot a mile away.
Exactly. Well, they even did a lie detector. So I did a lie detector.
Oh, no.
And they called me out on that one. They're like, hey, writer, you want a lie detector test? And I was like,
nope.
Yes. Oh, I did it. It was so cool. And I failed. And it was the second one I had in my life. I had one when I was in grade school. We went to the state police and they actually locked us up in the jail. It was actually a really cool experience. Well, they get to the point where they're like, anyone want to be go to lie detector? And I'm kind of like, I guess I don't know if I was 8, 9, 10 years old, whatever. So they bring me in the room, and what the guy did was he laid out a bunch of cards and he said, I'm going to show you a bunch of cards and I'm going to pick one up and only you will see what the card is. And I'm going to put it back in the deck. And then I'm going to go through every card I show you. You're going to say no. Even when I show the card that was your card, and I'll tell you what your card was. And I'm, you know, no, you won't. I can lie. I'm a kid. Come on. I lie all the time about, you know, whether I ate the candy or, you know, stole the fruit roll-ups or whatever. Yeah, whatever. You can't. Sure enough, he goes through the deck of cards and I don't remember now what it was, you know, six of clubs or whatever. Whatever card it was. No, 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 no. He gets in and he goes, if you win, I'll give you $10. And I'm like, I'm making $10. I walked out of there with $0.
$0.
Popped that card up and I'm like, oh, how did you know? Like, I'm smarter than you. Sorry, kid.
Yeah, I've done this before. Yeah.
And the FBI did the same thing to me. I thought, this one, I've watched these movies now. If I just like, can I put a tack in my shoe real quick and just get myself some pain every time or pinch myself? There's got to be something I can do. But those dastardly FBI agents caught me. So
my problem with those things is whenever I wrap, you know, I get strapped in, I'm sitting there and they're like, hey, you ever punched your wife? And I'm like, and my answer is like, well, I know I haven't ever punched my wife. And then as you're sitting there, you're like, well, did I punch my wife? No, I'm sure I've never punched my wife. I know for a fact that I've never punched my wife. But did you? I'm like, what? I'm like, and it's all internal dialogue.
It's all
like,
a head game.
I'm pretty sure I've never punched my wife, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be lying either. And now I'm like, oh man, I go in circles, man. Those things freak me out.
I swear like, she threw a frying pan at me one time. And so I tossed a pillow at her in self-defense. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. Have you ever sold illegal drugs? No, no, I know I haven't. Well, did you? I'm like, come on, you know, it's like, come on, stop it.
Problem is, if you're writing, then you're like, man, I've never done a drug in my life. And so if I ever got to a point where I was getting, you know, actually go through and have you ever done marijuana? My answer is no. But it's like, geez, I know people that have near me and I've researched it for books. It's like, I know what it smells like. I can walk in a place and be like, that's pot. But yeah. I never actually inhale, you know, Bill Clinton, you know, I didn't inhale it, you know, whatever. Yeah. So
that's exactly how my brain works. It's like, have you ever smoked pot? Well, no. Well, wait a minute. I was sitting in the yard at Darien Lake watching Dave Matthews and the people like right next to me were puffing up. So did I smoke pot? You know, it's like, oh,
so
no.
I've also seen Dave Matthews. If you've seen Dean Matthews, you have smoked marijuana because I've 98% of the air at Dave Matthews concert is legally marijuana. So yeah,
that's why in your brain, you're just like, well, what define smoking marijuana? Did exactly. I pack that bowl? I did not pack that bowl. Did I put that bowl to my lips? I did not pack that bowl. I did not.
What is this?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yep. No, Dave Matthews is my spirit animal. I can't wait till the new album comes out. I'm psyched.
But, I hope I wanted to see him last year. My son and I went on a concert run last year. Pretty amazing run. And he came through town, and I think I didn't have custody that night. There was some reason I didn't get tickets. So if I don't have custody this summer and he comes through, but he'll probably come to Charlotte. I'll go by myself because we were talking 80s. And so real quick, I'd never seen Bon Jovi. Mm-hmm. And so I took him to Charlotte to see Bon Jovi. I got floor seats. I think it was 12 rows from the stage. So I basically sold my kidney. it was one of the highlights of my time together as a father. And he still talks about it. He talked about it a couple of weeks ago, a year later, still talks about how amazing that concert was. And we had so much fun that it was, I think it was a Friday night. Yeah. Friday night in Charlotte. I saw him. He was coming. They were coming through Greenville on Monday. So 4 days later, or three nights later, I went and I didn't have custody then. I don't normally have custody on Monday nights. I went back and got a floor seat further back, much cheaper, but I got a floor seat and watched it a second time. And it was amazing experience. I had a blast. I then played back the videos I took after the fact, and I'm like, he sounds horrible. Didn't sound horrible there. There was amazing. The video, you know, maybe I won't go next time they come through, but yeah, we saw, and he wanted to see the Eagles. I made him pay for the Eagles. I made him give me $100 because it was more than 100. I said, well, I just took you to Bon Jovi. If you're going to see the Eagles, you got to put some skin in the game. This is called you're 15. This is adulthood. You're getting close. We saw Garth Brooks, Luke Bryan. The big one we saw was befriended through podcasts and through my book. I befriended the security director for Shinedown. So we went and saw Shinedown a couple times. And then I was fortunate that for research for books, I was able to get a pass, a world pass, and go with the band on some shows. Nice. I even went over to England. I saw him over in Wales back in November. So I did about 8 shows with Shinedown, and, you know, got backstage and interacting and doing all the fun stuff. And so that'll end up in a future book. I've already got some of that written. Yeah. Just one of those cool experiences that people are like, how did you get that experience? And I'm like, poop happens. I don't know what to tell you. Right. It happens. And right. If it happens, yeah. Go for it. Go all yep. in on it and enjoy the experience.
That train stops. Jump on. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's weird. The only bad thing, it's not a negative, but the downside of that is once you've had a pass around your neck and can go anywhere but pretty much on the stage during the show, it's hard to then go in the poor man's seats in section 300 and be like,
that's right.
I think I see Garth Brooks. No, that's someone else that lives. Yeah. It's really when you can literally at the Shinedown shows, look up and see Brent singing down at you. You're like, hey Brent, what's going on, dude. Buddy? Totally different experience.
That's awesome.
It was cool.
Yeah. We'll get there with my boys. They're not quite there yet, but that's approaching faster than I want it to. Let's just say that. Yeah.
And that's one of those things that I always tell people. And I heard it when I was younger and when my kids were younger and they're like, they grow up so fast. I'm like, yeah, I'm tired. Now that my son's 16, he just got his license a couple weeks ago. Now I'm like, holy crap. I like blinked and he, you know, we had some home videos playing a couple weeks ago and it was his first birthday and I think his fourth or fifth birthday. And it was just like, man, you're living in the moment. And I've always believed in living in the moment as best I can. And you do your best, you're being involved, but how quick it goes. It's really easy. So I try to do that now with the kids, especially since I don't have them half the time. It allows me half the time to work on writing, but that half time I'm with them, I don't. That's the other thing. People are like, well, how has that affected your writing? I do write sometimes when they go to sleep, but it's sometimes because a lot of times I put them to bed, you know, if they get up for school, mom and dad now, you know, when they're with me, and mm-hmm. same when they're with their mom, she's having to do all the roles. I got to clean the dishes. I have to get the stuff ready for tomorrow. I have to maybe fold clothes. I have to sometimes go to bed eventually. Writing's not on my radar. So I have to cram it into basically when I don't have the kids. And then unfortunately, by my own choice, a lot of times I'm on the go too. So I'm really, I'm struggling sometimes to say, I'm writing a book. Yeah, I wrote, you know, I wrote some of the book yesterday, but I only wrote, you know, a page versus, you know, a couple of years ago, I probably would have been like, I can knock a book out in 3 months.
Yeah,
that would be a challenge now.
Then, you know, just, you know, come 3 years from now, two more books, you'll have that. You'll be able to afford that 8-hour writing day, you know, with that 7-figure advance you get.
Maybe. Right? But the one thing that I do want to say to add to that is Don Winslow recently had a post, something on Twitter he said about that, is he had an open door policy that his son could come in anytime he was writing and he would stop what he was doing. He would focus on time. And he goes, you know, Don's obviously been an extremely successful writer and didn't achieve success until he was older too. But he said he is so grateful that he let that be the way it was because he didn't miss out on that time with the kids. And that's what I try to tell people. And that's why I normally write at nights or write when I don't have kids. It's like, they're only going to be that age for a certain period of time. And, you know, God willing, you live long enough to be able to write and watch your kids grow older and have kids themselves. But books matter. Books are important to me. But in the scheme of things, my time with my kids is really what's important. A book is great. It's lovely to have my book out. I love that I have them on my shelf. But it's just something on my shelf. That's not a memory I'll have with my kids the rest of my life and a memory that they'll have. So that's cool. It doesn't hold a candle to what's really cool, which is my kids.
Yeah. And getting to watch those little critters grow up, which I don't know if you can hear them or not, but it's getting loud. So I'm going to have to cut you loose pretty soon.
I thought that was a group of banshees in the background, but yeah, no, I don't hear anything.
That's exactly what that is.
Well, enjoy those times with them.
Yeah. I appreciate you coming to join me, man. It's been a great chat. And whenever the next one comes out, hit me up and we'll definitely link up again. Before you go, look forward to doing that. Socials for people, websites, stuff like that.
Yeah. So my website is my name. My middle initial is P for Paul. So EricPBishop.com. I'm on Twitter, EPB author. I think Twitter and Instagram, I'm EPB author, which my initials, EPB. Facebook, it should just be Eric Bishop author, Eric P. Bishop author, I think. So yeah, the good thing about the world and this horrible technology, this evil technology, all you have to do is go to Google and type in the Body Man, and guess what? It'll send you to Amazon and you can buy a copy. So piece of cake.
We're always available.
Always. Right? Always.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, John. Thank you for your time. Take care.
All right. Good night, everybody.